This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, criminal defense attorney Nancy Hollander joins us to speak about her former client Chelsea Manning and about her career as a defense lawyer for our occasional segment we call Lawyers You'll Like, and you'll like this one.
The Supreme Court recently ruled that the Community Access Station Manhattan Neighborhood Network is not a state actor. That means it can censor what shows go on the air and what people say on their shows.
That's exactly what they did with the five reactionary judges at the Supreme Court ruling against the First Amendment.
Stay with us.
New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
Occasionally, Law and Disorder has featured interviews with significant attorneys. We call this segment of the show Lawyers You'll Like. One such attorney is today's guest, Nancy Hollander. She's been practicing criminal defense law in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and has been a partner since 1980 in the law firm of Friedman Boyd Hollander, Goldman Urias and Ward. Nancy Hollander's practice has largely been devoted to representing individuals and organizations accused of crimes, including those involving national security issues. She was one of the attorneys in the landmark Holy Land Five case, which ended badly. She won whistleblower Chelsea Manning's release in 2017 when President Obama commuted her sentence from 35 years to 7 years. Although not currently representing Manning, she has met with her recently. Manning has been jailed for 2 months for refusing to cooperate with a grand jury in Virginia, which is investigating Julian Assange of WikiLeaks. Manning released the famous Iraqi war log video showing American war crimes in Iraq to Julian Assange at WikiLeaks. He's in prison in London, awaiting extradition and trial in Virginia, where he faces a 175-year prison sentence if convicted of espionage. Hollander represented Mohammed Oud Salih, whose release she obtained after he served 15 years in Guantanamo without even being charged. Nancy Hollander was the first woman president of the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers. She's listed in Best Lawyers in America, and in 2001 was named one of America's top 50 women litigators. She graduated from the University of Michigan in the 1960s, and much later from the law school at the University of New Mexico. Nancy Hollander, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thanks. It's always great to be here.
Chelsea Manning served 7 years in prison, two of them in solitary on a 35-year sentence. She tried twice to commit suicide while in prison. What did she do to get in such trouble, to get such a long sentence?
Well, she shouldn't have had such a long sentence. I think she was only in solitary for 11 months, but it doesn't matter. She's in solitary again now. So, you know, she disclosed a lot of documents, a large number of documents, because she believed that people should know what was happening in the, quote, fog of war, that real people were getting killed, real people were getting injured, and that the U.S. was committing war crimes. She felt compelled to disclose this information, and that's what she was tried and convicted for.
Yeah, I remember seeing the video that she disclosed of American helicopter pilots gloating over their murder of a couple of Reuters journalists and other civilians. And she got that out to millions of people.
She did, and she actually was found not guilty of that one, but interestingly enough. But yes, that was the most visual. But there were others, and there was information that she got out that she felt people should know.
Evidently, they didn't like her telling their secrets. How did you get her out of prison after 7 years?
Well, she applied for clemency, and frankly, I didn't think we'd get it. She didn't think we'd get it, but we decided that it was a good idea to do. It kept her case alive. It kept telling her story, which was important to her, what she had done. So we applied. She didn't meet any of the qualifications for the Army or the President. But the president decided to grant her clemency, and she got out. That's what happened. I was there. I went to Kansas to make sure she got out. I was afraid that Trump might try to stop it.
She's in jail now in Virginia. Why?
Chelsea was subpoenaed to the grand jury to give questions about Julian Assange, who we know has been indicted and is facing extradition in England. She refused. She refused on a couple of grounds, as I understand her position. She doesn't believe that we should have grand juries, which is a viable position to take. They're antiquated, secret theaters. There's a federal judge who once said a prosecutor could indict a ham sandwich in a grand jury because there's nobody there but the prosecutor. And she also was concerned, she didn't remember everything else she had said, that this was a trap, a perjury trap. And even though they gave her immunity, so she didn't have any Fifth Amendment right to object on the grounds that it would incriminate her, but that never includes perjury. So she had that fear also. And she just decided she wasn't going to do it, and it's a very bold stand to take, but it's like her previous bold stand, she did it.
She really is a person of integrity.
Yes, she is a person of integrity, and she believes very strongly in this. And, you know, my fear for Chelsea is that the government is looking for a way to get her back into prison, that there are people who are upset that she got clemency, and I fear that she'll always have to be looking over her back for those people.
Well, they're doing something else to her. The judge ordered that she be fined $500 a day for every day she doesn't come and testify, and that fine is going to be doubled to $1,000 a day, I think, July 1st. So my question is financially ruining a person an unusual government tactic?
I haven't checked the cases, Michael, or done any research on this, but it seems fairly outrageous to me. It's a measure of the judge trying to get her to testify, trying to force her to testify. And at some point, the court has to realize that this has become a punishment, being in prison, and has to deal with that. I know her lawyers have raised that in their motions, have raised the issue of the money, but it's a serious issue, and I don't know where it's going.
What can our listeners do to show support to Chelsea Manning?
Well, you can write to Chelsea. Her address is public, the address of the prison. You can write to her and show support that way. People can show support by writing about her case. She gets plenty of letters. I think being public about support for her, my view, is more important. People also can go learn more about her story. A documentary is out now called XY Chelsea. It's streaming on Showtime, and you can learn more about her and about who she is.
We'll put up the address for Chelsea Manning's prison on our website, lawanddisorder.org. I'm pleased to hear that you can actually write her without having to get prior permission. But let me now kind of segue into the lawyers you'll like portion of our interview, Nancy Hollander, and ask you this. You were at the University of Michigan in the 60s. I was next door at the University of Wisconsin. But Michigan had the distinction of being the place where SDS was formed. And I wanted to know, what was your experience there with SDS?
I learned about something called Voice Political Party when I first got to Michigan. Actually, I went to Michigan the spring before I was to go there for some interviews, and my father saw a leaflet and said, "You might be interested in this." And there it was, Voice Political Party. I ultimately became a chairman or chairwoman or whatever you call it, a Voice, and Voice became an SDS chapter.
What kind of activities were you involved in with them at Michigan?
The activities I remember were bringing speakers and pushing the university. We brought Malcolm X,
yeah.
And I introduced him.
Great.
And I think he called me the blue-eyed devil, but he was very gracious. We had a little reception for him afterwards. We brought a guy named Wilkerson, who had been in jail. He came with someone else, and I forget the other one's name, but they had both been in jail for violating or refusing to testify in front of HUAC, I think, the House Un-American Activities Committee. And we mostly, what I remember is that we brought speakers. I'm sure we did other things, too.
And then you continued after you graduated from Michigan. Where'd you go, to Chicago with SDS?
Well, first I went, after Michigan, I went to Cleveland and was organizing. I organized women in a project to complain about the situation of welfare. And we also were doing other organizing. That was the summer of 1964. And then I went to Chicago and joined what already existed there, an organization called JOIN, Jobs or Income Now, and was organizing people from Appalachia, then wrote a book about Appalachia called Uptown, learned to be a photographer in Jesse Jackson's church in the basement. That's where I learned photography from a guy who taught me how to use a darkroom, and became a kind of street photographer. I went to Indonesia and met with the Vietnamese women, and I stayed in Chicago until 1968 when I went to Cincinnati and was organizing there and then went back to Chicago.
And how'd you end up in New Mexico?
I came to New Mexico for a lot of personal reasons. My parents had moved to New Mexico, and I had a place where I could go. I had a young child, and so I moved to New Mexico. My parents had a party to introduce me to people, and one of the people they introduced me to was a man named Paul Phillips, who was the chairperson of the ACLU in New Mexico, and I became the executive director of the New Mexico Civil Liberties Union.
So you're not a lawyer, but you're the executive director of the New Mexico Civil Liberties Union.
Right. I was not a lawyer at that time. I had no plans to become a lawyer. I ran this organization. It was a small organization. I ran it by myself.
Well, what was it that influenced you to then go to law school? You did things exactly backwards.
I did things backwards, but I was actually always planning to go to medical school. And I had been gone to college as a chemistry major. I changed that to sociology because I didn't have time for all the lab courses because I was doing so much demonstrating in university. But then I thought about going to medical school again, and I talked to a woman who actually read my palm, and she said, medicine is in your future. And it kind of scared me because I really was thinking of going to medical school still. I was 30 years old. I had a 5-year-old child. And I met a friend of mine for coffee one morning, and she said, well, you should go to law school. That's the medicine that you do. And I applied to law school and got in, and that's how it happened. I'd never thought about it before.
Being a woman lawyer, especially a criminal defense lawyer, put you in a real minority, particularly at the beginning. Talk about that, please.
Well, I went to law school to become a criminal defense lawyer. It's the only thing I was interested in. That's what I'd been doing in the ACLU, really. I knew by that time most of the judges, a lot of the lawyers, and that's all I was interested in. And I went, I did it. Yes, there were very few women lawyers. I ultimately became the first woman president of the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, which is the national organization. But, you know, there were things that happened. There were judges that called everyone in the courtroom gentlemen, even though there were women. And I had to have a little conversation with this judge and said, when I refused to stand up, when he said, gentlemen, approach the bench, and I didn't approach. And he said, Miss Hollander, what's the problem? And I said, well, I'm not a man. And maybe you could solve this problem? He said, well, I'm concerned about this because I'm not used to having women in my courtroom. How can I solve it? I said, well, you could call people sir some days and ma'am other days, or you could just refer to us all as counsel. He said, well, that's a brilliant idea. It was things like that.
I remember when I was in law school, which was a few years before you, I went to NYU, and 10% of the class were women. And they used to brag about that. And, you know, they had a huge population of women at 10%. Flo Kennedy, the wonderful African-American attorney, applied to Columbia Law School in 1949, and they turned her down. And she went over there, and she said, you turned me down, and I'm going to sue you because you turned me down because I'm black. And the dean said, no, we turned you down because you're a woman. So she intimidated him because she was good at that, and they let her in. But there were no toilet facilities for her at Columbia Law School. She was the only woman in the class. So that's where it started out. There was a time in the United States where there may be one or two women lawyers in the whole country. And now my law professor friends tell me half the classes are women now.
Well, actually, half of my class was women.
Really?
It was the first class with half women. And that was in 1975 when I went to law school.
Yeah, I went 11 years before that when it was just beginning to change.
Right. But they still didn't have enough bathrooms in the law school for women. They had men's bathrooms all over the place and one women's bathroom. We had to fight to get them to give us a bathroom.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. You wrote a New York Times piece where you indicated that, quote, I am a terrorist lawyer and proud of it. Why do you say that?
I actually wrote that headline, although people think the editors wrote that headline. What I meant by it was exactly what I wrote in the piece, which is people were accusing lawyers at that time of being like their clients when their clients were charged with terrorism, that the lawyers were terrorists. And I wrote it because I said, that doesn't make any sense, first of all. I never get accused of baby rape when I represent someone who's raped a child, for example, or murder. And some of the finest people in this country have defended some of the most hated people in the country and stood up and were proud of it. And I'm proud of it. And that's really what I was trying to say, that I'm a lawyer. I'm not a terrorist.
I remember reading David McCulloch's book on John Adams, where he writes about Adams defending a British soldier in 1774, before the American Revolution started, when Boston was occupied by what they called lobsterbacks, you know, these red-coated mm-hmm. British soldiers, and there was a melee. The British soldier was charged with murdering a Boston citizen, and John Adams, who had gone to Harvard Law School, defended him.
Yes, and John Adams wrote that it was his finest hour as a lawyer. Yeah. And there are many other examples of that.
Yeah.
And I wanted to make that clear. The fact that I wrote terrorist lawyer is also a bit of irony for me because I don't think we should even use the word terrorist. I don't think we should have the crime of terrorism. That's a whole other discussion I'm willing to have at some point. But it's just a political definition. It's always a political crime.
Well, coming back to the idea that attorneys represent the Constitution and not the client in particular or defend what they did, what was your reaction to the news that Harvard Law professor attorney Ron Sullivan was forced by the student body there to abandon his defense of Harvey Weinstein, who has been accused of numerous sexual crimes?
I was outraged by that, absolutely outraged. Harvey Weinstein, regardless of what we think of him, is as entitled to a defense as anyone else. And because it's the same problem, because the lawyer is defending him and defending his rights to due process, his rights under the Constitution, does not mean that the lawyer is any kind of a bad person. And in fact, Harvey Weinstein is innocent until proven guilty. So I don't care what anyone thinks about him. It was a dangerous precedent for Harvard to do that. And I wonder whether they would have done it to a white man, by the way.
Nancy Hollander, there's a documentary that you're in. It's now streaming on Showtime. Please tell us about that.
Well, that documentary, which I mentioned earlier, is called XY Chelsea. It's streaming on Showtime. I actually went to the premiere at Tribeca. It starts with the clemency, actually, and then goes back. It kind of goes back and forth throughout its 90 minutes to what Chelsea did, and ends with where she is right now in the grand jury problem. And I think it's a very good documentary. I was very active in making it with Tim Hawkins, who's the director and filmmaker, and I've spent a lot of time with the producers at Pulse, and I think they made a good film. It's interesting that the film is totally different than how it was originally planned, because when it started, nobody knew Chelsea was going to get out. But once she got out, they had to completely redo the film. But one of the things that was wonderful was that Tim was in my office sitting there. He and I were actually going to go to the Women's March together. We were in Albuquerque, and he was sitting in my office with his camera on my desk when I got the call from the president. So it's a great moment that he was able to capture.
XY Chelsea, you got a call from the president himself?
The president's counsel. And
what did he say?
My secretary, I was actually on the phone, on my cell phone, to a reporter talking just in general about Chelsea and what did I think the president was going to do, etc. And my secretary or the receptionist cuts in and says, Nancy, you have a call from the president's office. And I said to this reporter, I have to go now. And he said, will you call me back? And I said, I don't know, I have to go now. And I hung up and answered the phone. And it was he said, I'm counsel for the president. The president is going to announce in two minutes, that he's given your client clemency. So you might want to turn on your television. I'm sorry we didn't give you more time about this. And I said, does Chelsea know? And he said, we're getting the information to her. I hung up and ran down the hall to find my co-counsel, Vince Ward, who was in a meeting with a client. And that's the kind of thing you never interrupt. But I knocked on the door and said, excuse me, Vince, I need to talk to you. And he came out in the hall. And we jumped around and screamed and yelled and hugged. And everybody from the office came out. It was a great moment. And then 120 days later, I went to Kansas to get her out.
And what was Chelsea's reaction when she saw you?
Well, she, of course, had seen me. You mean when we got her out?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, she was waiting for us. She was in it. We pulled up in a van. We had these escorts who were with us, these security guys who had been hired, and Chase Strangio from the ACLU, who represented her on the prison stuff having to do with getting hormones. He and I were in the car. We had flak jackets on because Kansas is an open carry state, and there was some concern that someone might try to kill her and therefore us. And we went into the prison, and she was in another van, and that van opened. She got out, got in our van. It was about 3 minutes after midnight on the day. She got in our van. We drove away, and until we got out of that prison, I was not absolutely convinced that President Trump wouldn't do something. But once we got out, we had an escort from the military. We had a sheriff, and we drove onto the tarmac of the Kansas International Airport up to a waiting jet that we got on.
You got the hell out of town.
We got out and went to a safe house for about 4 days. And that's all in the movie.
Great. XY Chelsea, streaming on Showtime. Nancy, let me ask you a broader question, something that all of us are deeply concerned about in these dire political times. How do you appreciate the current state of democracy and the rule of law in our country. Are they compatible with capitalism and imperialism?
Well, obviously, they're not compatible. We don't have a democracy. We have very close at this time to a dictatorship. The president seems to be able to get away with whatever he wants. The executive and the judiciary are slowly getting molded into a new shape. So we don't really have a democracy.
What advice would you give to young people, particularly those who are in or thinking about going to law school, you know, given your appreciation of the situation that we find ourselves in?
Well, you know, we have to keep fighting. There's another documentary, and I don't know how to find it yet, but it's about an Israeli woman named Liat Semel, who continues to lose cases and has been losing cases in Israel in the military courts representing Palestinians for years. I mean, she just keeps losing and keeps going, and we have to keep going. And if I were going to law school right now, I'd learn everything I could about immigration law, because that's where lawyers are the most needed now, you know, and fight for the rights of people who don't have any rights, who at the moment, more than at other times in our history, although it's been true in the past, involves the situation involving immigrants around the country.
We had Ramsey Clark, the former Attorney General, in the studio, sitting in the same chair you're sitting in, Nancy Hollander, and Michael Ratner and I asked him that question. He said, you have to have hope, because without hope, you don't do anything.
Yeah, you have to believe that you can make a change. Lawyers have tremendous power, have more power than probably any other profession, because it's the power to make change. Doctors don't have that power. They cure one person, or maybe invent a cure that cures lots of people, and that makes change, but that's pretty rare. But every lawyer has the ability to make change, whether it's a criminal case or a class action case that changes things for a lot of people, or winning a injury case for a person. That's making change. And sometimes we can only make change for one person. Sometimes we can only unite one parent and one child who's currently in a concentration camp. That family coming together will make change in the future. So, yes, we have to have hope. And I just keep Leah, who I know, Liat Semel, is a real inspiration, because she just keeps going and keeps losing.
An inspiration for me also. We've come to the end of our allotted time, Nancy Hollander. It's been a real pleasure to have you on Law and Disorder. We thank you very much, and we look forward to having you back.
Well, I hope you'll have me back, Michael. I love coming and having these discussions.
You take it easy.
You too. Bye-bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
In late June, the United States Supreme Court, in a 5-4 decision written by Brett Kavanaugh, decided that TV cable companies can, in the words of our guest, losing plaintiff Dee Dee Halleck, quote, censor whatever, whoever, and whenever they want. Cable companies like Manhattan Neighborhood Network can now limit public access. The Supreme Court held that Manhattan Neighborhood Network is not subject to First Amendment constraints, that the Free Speech Clause of the First Amendment prohibits only governmental, not private, abridgment of speech, and it held that MNN is a private company. Judges Kavanaugh, Robert, Thomas, Alito, and Gorsuch found against the free speech argument of Halleck and her co-plaintiff, Jesus Melendez. Judge Sotomayor wrote the dissent, which was joined by Ginsburg, Breyer, and Kagan. Dee Dee Halleck, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Hi, thank you. Glad to be here.
Well, we're very sorry to hear about the Supreme Court's disappointing decision. Were you surprised that they ruled against you?
Well, I guess if my eternal optimism, I had some kind of hope that maybe we could have gotten one of the conservative justices to care about public access and local information. But I think we're past that now in this society. It's very upsetting and disappointing.
We've talked about this case on earlier episodes of Law and Disorder, but just so listeners have a refresher on the facts, you and Jesus Melendez made a film that was not allowed to air a while back on the station. Is that correct?
That's correct, but it started before that when the community media grants, which were $300,000, it was doled out by $5,000, $10,000, $20,000 to over 300 community groups, and they were precipitously dropped. Papo had been earning a living with one of those grants, and a group of us, there were nine of us, I believe, tried to go to a board meeting and were told that the board meeting was closed, which it wasn't because they hadn't changed the bylaws, and the bylaws said that the board meetings were open. But anyway, that it goes way back. So the film was really about Papaletto being dropped from the community leadership group, which was in training at the brand new Firehouse Studios.
And just to clarify, Papo is Papaletto, is Melendez. This is all the same person here.
Yes, Papaletto is a Puerto Rican poet who had been selected attempt to introduce community leaders to the Firehouse and the new studios, which MNN was opening up with a lot of fanfare in East Harlem in the barrio. And so he, along with a number of us, went to the board meeting and were told that we couldn't make a present. We wanted to ask to get the community media grants back. So that's, I feel, really more than the actual videotape. What happened was the day after we attempted to go to the board meeting, he was told that he could no longer come to the community leadership classes. And not only that, but that he couldn't come into the building at all. So we made a videotape of him attempting to get into the building. That's really what the videotape was, and being told by various people, guards at the door, et cetera, that he couldn't get in. And then we interviewed people who were coming there for the opening of the building. The tape was called threatening. There's nothing threatening at all in the tape. It's kind of Papaletto being a kind of stand-up comic, talking about why can't he get into his neighborhood media center. But it was seen as criticizing Manhattan Neighborhood Network. So they continued with the ban of Papaletto, and then I got banned. And I got banned first for 3 months, and then when I put it on YouTube, they banned me for a year, saying that I shouldn't have put it on YouTube, even though they don't have anything to do with YouTube, but they felt that that they needed to punish me more or something. So
Dee Dee, I want to clarify for the listening audience that the thrust of your argument before the Supreme Court was that Manhattan Neighborhood Network is actually a government actor, and that would mean that they are not allowed to limit free speech under the First Amendment. And the Supreme Court found what we didn't want, that they are not a government actor. They're a private actor, and that means they can censor and decide what programming to include.
Yeah, the whole premise of public access is because the cable company has a monopoly on the information that is going through the public rights of way, that there needs to be a channel for people to have free speech. And this is from the early days, in the early 70s, and this has been the case, that public access is what they call first come, first serve, meaning that they put it on the air without having any censorship or even looking at it. It's the reason for having public access is to be able to exercise your First Amendment rights. And that is stated in the local handbook of Manhattan Neighborhood Network. It says that provides Manhattan residents with means by which they can exercise their First Amendment rights. So they said, well, we're private, and therefore we don't have to adhere to the First Amendment. But their privacy, their budget, comes directly from a city contract. It is the contract that the city makes with the cable company to utilize their rights of way, the underground cables and manholes and the above ground wires are public rights of way. And so this was kind of the payback. So the public access entity is a nonprofit corporation, and that is private, but they do have two members who are delegated by the Manhattan Borough President's Office on the board. Gail Brewer did not take any stand in defending my First Amendment rights, nor Papaletto's. We feel that and our lawyers argued that even though the organization that administers the public access is private, it is operating on money that is an essentially public money.
Dee Dee Halleck, what are the origins of Manhattan Neighborhood Network, and were you personally involved when it came into being?
Yes, I started making programs on public access in the late 70s with a show called Communications Update, which was about media issues, and then later it became Paper Tiger Television in 1981, and we used to take the tapes and give them to the Manhattan Cable, and they would run them, but there was no center, there was no equipment that we could use. We had to use a commercial studio, but I knew that there were public access entities around the country that were flourishing and had become an important resource for people who wanted to make video. And so myself, Kathy Scott, a number of people from Paper Tiger, and working together with FAIR, with Jeff Cohen and Janine Jackson, a number of activists who are working with media. We also worked with the United Church of Christ, had a communication office where they were promoting people's access to the airwaves. Everett Parker was the dean of that office. He was a minister in the United Church of Christ who had fought to get a station in Mississippi open to African Americans who had been basically cut out of a television station in the middle of a black majority population. And so he had an abiding interest in promoting people's access to public media. And so the United Church of Christ helped us. We picketed, we made the cardboard TV cameras, and we marched all around the offices of Manhattan Cable, and we also the city hall. We went to hearings at the city council and organized demonstrations. And finally, after over 2.5 years of very active organizing, we were able to force the city to pay attention and to set up public access in Manhattan. There already was public access in, of all places, Staten Island, founded by Trish Dare, who was a pioneer in public access and was able to get public access there. So we actually took Ruth Messenger out to Staten Island and said, look, this is what they have in Staten Island, where they had the center and cameras and things that people could use, and there's nothing in Manhattan. So finally we were able to convince the city council to enable us to set up, and there had been money put in escrow. Morris Tarshis was the head of franchise, and he had put money in escrow, which enabled Manhattan Neighborhood Network to really build a center that was open to people for use.
Let's talk about Manhattan Neighborhood Network now. They have a tremendous amount of funding, don't they?
They get $11 million a year. And that is why when Ruth Messenger was the borough president, she insisted that they give some of that money, which were the community media grants, to various nonprofit organizations throughout the community, so that they could learn to use video and have space to edit, and would encourage them to be participants, because a lot of people think of public access as Wayne's World, as some teenager down in this basement playing on a guitar, which it is. There are some like that, but there are also different activist organizations, various Chinese workers unions. The New York Civil Liberties Union had received a community media grant. Paper Tiger received grants. The Union Settlement received grants. Henry Street Settlement received grants to do short videos, programming for the public access, and with these community media grants. I think it was very effective. There were 300 different community organizations that received these grants and worked with their group. So it wasn't just like one person. They weren't individual grants. They were grants to community organizations to make programming. So, and it was the elimination of those grants that was particularly upsetting to not just myself and Papaletto, but also to unions, various organizations.
Well, you're anticipating my next question, Dee Dee. And I want to preface my question by telling our audience that you're well known, being the when I first met you years ago, I was told you're the mother of community video, and you certainly have been central to the whole development of this marvelous, really free speech effort. So who supported you in this lawsuit? And then secondly, who opposed you?
Well, we did not, we had two pro bono lawyers, Robert Perry, who has litigated in the Supreme Court before for public access in the Denver area case. Another decision that wasn't totally positive, but had some positive outcomes, and it was kind of mixed, actually. But we had Paul Hughes, who was a pro bono lawyer. They worked very hard. This was a very complicated case, and there are many issues that it touches on. So,
Dee Dee, who supported you with respect to amicus briefs? And then my next question is going to be who opposed you. But what organizations wrote amicus briefs for you in this lawsuit?
We were very lucky to and thrilled that the American Civil Liberties Union wrote a very strong brief. The Prisoner Police Accountability Project of the National Lawyers Guild wrote us a very strong brief. The New York Lawyers Association, the New York Civil Liberties Union, the National Campaign Against Censorship. We were really overwhelmed with many people who realized that this was an important issue and that they really wanted to help our case.
And who opposed you? I was shocked, and I'm not going to give it away, but what organizations opposed you with amicus briefs against you?
Three groups that are completely supported by the Koch brothers. One is the Cato Institute, which does get some other funding, but their main funding is the Koch brothers. And two kind of strange groups. One is called the Atlantic Legal Foundation, and the other is the Pacific Legal Foundation. And both of those groups are practically only supported by the Koch brothers, and they have taken like incredible cases where they stand up for homophobia. I think they helped out the baker who didn't want to bake the wedding cake for a gay wedding. Those two organizations have been very active in supporting all the different cases that are trying to eliminate abortion rights. So I can't believe that Manhattan Neighborhood Network would even want to be associated with these groups. But that's who wrote their briefs for them.
Dee Dee, I have a question. We know that Manhattan Neighborhood Network has huge funding. Talk a bit about the salaries of the people who lead that entity.
Well, there is four very high, highly paid salaries. So, if I questioned that, I was told, well, they have such a big budget, but if you compare it with, say, the Bronx Defenders, which gets, I think, $25,000 from the city through a contract with the city. But the Bronx Defenders director it certainly doesn't make as much as MNN. Unfortunately, there's no reporting. I don't think they've turned in their 2017 taxes, but the 2016 taxes say that the director made $370,000, I believe it was, and there have been three raises since then, so who knows? It's like they're probably, I'm sure they're up to close to $500,000.
And who's the director?
The director is Dan Coughlin.
And are there other executives at that organization that make equally large salaries?
Yes, a financial person who also makes above $200,000, and then the other various people make like $170,000, something like that. But you're talking about an organization. The person who worked, who was the director before Dan Coughlin came in, made $80,000. So the executive salaries have been climbing very rapidly, and unfortunately, the same year that the executive salary went up is the same year that the community media grants were cut out. So that's where the money's coming from, I guess.
Didi Halleck, what does this loss mean to the movement?
Well, I've been reading that people have reacted a lot. People feel that it definitely aspect is that it makes public access programs more vulnerable, because in the past they could say, well, we can't censor, we can't edit, and basically what the wording of the law seems to say, that the administrators of public access stations have not only a right but a duty to actually be more circumspect in what they allow on the air, which I guess will make the Koch brothers very happy if people start raging against the climate change, etc., and they can say, well, we can't put angry people on the air or whatever. I mean, it could have very, very strong repercussions in terms of how directors of public access use the airways. It's very upsetting.
Didi, are you allowed back in the studios?
Well, I was told I was back in. I haven't tried, because I've been so busy working on the case. It's been 6 years we've worked on this case.
6 years.
Six years since we first requested to have a meeting about the reinstating the community media grant. So it's been a 6-year struggle.
I just want to observe that this is one of the first decisions of the court since Kavanaugh has joined. He was one of the five. He wrote the decision. Yeah, what it does is, I'm afraid, presages some very bad decisions that are going to come up in the future. And I'm particularly thinking about the abortion question that's going to come up before these five reactionary judges. Didi, Heidi and I want to thank you very much for your good work.
Yes.
And thank you for being on Law and Disorder.
Well, thank you for being an open channel for information, which we've got to keep as many of these channels open as possible so we can keep getting our ideas out there. Thank you.
Thank you, Didi. We'll hope to talk with you soon.
Okay.
Thank you, Didi.
Bye.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org.